Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at anemia, a condition in which the blood does not have enough red blood cells. But first, Nigeria is battling to contain the outbreak of diphtheria, which has killed around 800 people and infected 14,000. It has spread to almost half of the country's 36 states, with Kano accounting for the bulk of cases and deaths. Nigeria's Center for Disease Control declared an outbreak of the diphtheria in January after cases began to surface in May last year. A spokesperson from Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, says the outbreak, quote, has already surpassed the worst outbreak, which had 5,039 cases in 1989. Diphtheria is a highly contagious and potentially life-threatening bacterial disease which affects the respiratory tract and skin. October 24th is World Polio Day. The day aims to bring attention to polio and step up efforts toward polio eradication. Polio is a highly infectious viral disease that largely affects children under five. The virus is mainly spread from person to person, typically through contaminated water. It can attack the nervous system and, in some cases, lead to paralysis. According to the World Health Organization, wild poliovirus cases have decreased by over 99% since 1988. As of 2022, the wild poliovirus remains endemic in Pakistan and Afghanistan. We turn now to anemia, one of the most common blood disorders in the world. Anemia occurs when the body does not have enough red blood cells to carry oxygen to the organs and tissues. Experts say women and children under five are more vulnerable to the disease. Almost 2 billion people worldwide were affected by anemia in 2021, according to the WHO. WHO says issues such as poor nutrition, infections, chronic diseases, heavy menstruation, pregnancy issues, and family history can lead to anemia. And in many low and lower middle income settings, the most common causes of anemia are iron deficiency and malaria. Some symptoms of anemia include tiredness, headaches, and shortness of breath. Observers say in Africa, anemia is especially prevalent in Western and Central Africa. From Nairobi, Kenya, Mohamed Yusuf reports on the scope of the problem.
Miriam Kuta and Sylvia Anyango have anemia, a condition that affects one in four people worldwide. According to the World Health Organization, women are considered anemic when their red blood cell concentration falls below 12 grams per deciliter and men below 13 grams per deciliter. Kita and Anyango partly blame their anemia on pregnancy.
I think I got anemia because I got pregnant again soon after giving birth, and I cannot afford healthy foods.
I cannot get my blood levels to the required minimum because I would need vegetables to have enough blood in my body. And also, when I give birth, I would be at a disadvantage.
According to health experts, anemia during pregnancy is linked to increased rates of preterm labor, postpartum hemorrhage, low birth weight, stillbirth, and infections in both child and mother. Symptoms of anemia include shortness of breath, dizziness, and fatigue. Doctors say a key cause of anemia is a lack of food containing iron, a mineral the body needs for growth and development. Key sources of iron include red meat, poultry, fish, and eggs.
What I've been witnessing is the increase in iron deficiency anemia, and the most significant contributing factor is household food insecurity. So many of our patients are unable to afford iron-rich foods or basically food at all. They always end up skipping meals to survive or reducing the quantity of food to be consumed or the quality of food.
A 2023 study by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation found that the primary cause of anemia in 2021 was insufficient dietary iron intake. Iron deficiency accounted for two-thirds of all cases of anemia, affecting 825 million women and 444 million men worldwide. According to the study, sub-Saharan Africa bore the greatest burden of anemia and countries like Mali, Togo and Zambia had a more than 50% prevalence. Anemia can be treated with better nutrition.
So once this is detected, we start by introducing iron-rich foods to this person. We can also introduce iron supplements. And this has been the mainstay of which the government is also putting much emphasis on this. If this anemia is extreme or severe, we can do blood transfusion, where we now have to supplement whatever the blood volume that the patient already has.
The World Health Organization aims to reduce the prevalence of anemia among women of reproductive age to at least 50% of 2012 levels by year 2030. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
We asked listeners what they knew about anemia and if they could share the name of some food with a good source of iron. Here are some reactions from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
I know that anemia is an iron deficiency. It could be a disease or a condition. Yeah. There's the sickle cell anemia. That's a different, it's like a disease. So you get a medication and you're advised on nutrition. And there's another anemia, the condition now, when you are told that you have iron deficiency. When you have iron deficiency, you are advised on mostly nutrition.
As a mother, a pregnant mother first, you need to do antenatal clinics if you're a pregnant woman, so that you can avoid being anemic. And another way, if you have a child, a newborn, make sure that that child exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months.
I know that anemia is caused by lack of iron in the body or in the blood. Yes, and when you're anemic, you tend to not be having sufficient blood in your body. Yeah, which can cause health complications.
Foods that are rich in iron, I can say like spinach. That's also one of them which I was told when I was very young about spinach, the fruits, and also we can also have the broccoli, also the beetroot.
Now here is. Now here is more on anemia from an expert in Nigeria.
Anemia simply means a reduction in the hemoglobin concentration in the blood. And this hemoglobin, it's contained in the red cells. And the hemoglobin, it's the substance or that the pigment, the substance that transports oxygen around the body. Most is women and children. These are the two groups that are more likely to have anemia. One, in the case of women, because of their monthly cycles, then also because of during pregnancy. During childbirth too, they are at risk of losing large amounts of blood. While in the case of children, because they are growing, then secondly, mostly children used to move around, especially those that stay around the swamp or rivers, they tend to go and drink water from the swamp, which mostly because of it's not clean, it can affect the kidney, what we can lead to what we call acute tubular necrosis. In the brain, you can have what is called watershed infarct. You can have ischemic infarcts in the heart. Treatment basically, it's either drugs or through blood transfusion. But apart from that, nutrition is also very important. So if a person comes and is already manifesting with anemia, one, we advise him on the proper diet to be taking, depending on the type of anemia he's having. So mostly red meat is rich in iron. Then dairy products are rich in vitamin B12. Then vegetables are rich in folate. So we advise the patient on the appropriate diet to take. This is one. Then secondly, we also place the patient on some medications. drugs that we use normally to treat anemia. Then, if there is need to transfuse the patient, if the anemia is, the patient is manifesting with symptoms and warrants transfusion, that's transfusing the patient with blood, we go ahead and transfuse the patient.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This week on Straight Talk Africa, the war between Israel and Hamas is intensifying and the death toll in Gaza is rising. Join me, Heidi Adams, and my guests for an in-depth discussion on the Israel-Hamas war on the next Straight Talk Africa. This Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Welcome back to Health Chat. We turn now to breast cancer. In Zambia, authorities say breast cancer cases among younger women are on the rise. Increasingly, the cases are diagnosed at an already advanced stage, complicating treatment and increasing the risk of fatality. Kathy Short reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
Dr. Catherine Mwaba is the head of the Radiation and Clinical Oncology Unit at the Cancer Diseases Hospital in Lusaka, Zambia. Mwaba told VOA that her hospital, the only specialized cancer treatment center in the country, sees between 2,700 and 3,000 new cancer patients each year. Many patients must travel long distances to get treatment. Mwaba says she has noticed a disturbing trend among the hospital's breast cancer patients.
In our hospital, we see on average about 200 to 250 new breast cancer patients. What is particularly not noticeable among our patients is that they are of a young age, with an average age of your breast cancer patient about 45. That's really their reproductive age. The other one is that they get very aggressive types of breast cancer.
Mwaba says the rise in breast cancer cases among younger women could be due to many reasons, including urbanization, lack of regular physical exercise, a westernized diet, obesity, having children late, and not breastfeeding. She adds that inadequate health insurance and follow-up care and a failure to complete therapy also contribute to the increase. Yudi Favor Soko is a two-time cancer survivor. She had cancer of the lymph nodes when she was 23 and breast cancer in 2015 before her 50th birthday.
So I was dealing with a lot of emotions, psychosocial emotions, you know, really. Not so much the physical part, but the emotional and spiritual part was very difficult for me.
Wanting to help others tackle that mental element, Soko founded the Zambian Cancer Society, a non-profit aimed at improving the lives of the country's cancer patients. Kazimbe Chenda is a 22-year-old kidney cancer survivor. Chenda now wants to start a conversation about living with cancer.
Yes, I feel there's a stigma because if someone who's got cancer, they would describe you. They would describe cancer as a death disease, whereby if you've got cancer, they would think like you would die of cancer. But actually, you can live with cancer, and you can just live a normal life with cancer.
Recently, Zambia's Health Minister, Sylvia Masewo, announced plans to build two more cancer hospitals in the country to address the growing number of cases. For now, the wards at Zambia's Cancer Diseases Hospital are often filled to capacity, and patients may have to wait a long time before receiving potentially life-saving treatment. Kathy Short, VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Now, 6 months into Sudan's conflict between the army and the rapid support forces, humanitarian agencies warn that the country is experiencing its worst hunger crisis ever. Lenny Kinsley, spokesperson for the World Food Programme in Sudan, tells VOA's Nabil Biagio that millions of Sudanese people urgently require food assistance, but accessing them remains challenging due to ongoing fighting. Take a listen.
42% of the population, or 20 million people, are now facing acute hunger, do not know where their next meal could come from. And of those, 6.3 million people are in emergency levels of hunger, which is just one step away from famine. And the situation and the conflict as it continues and it spreads is only making the situation even worse. We're very concerned that agricultural productivity and the upcoming harvest season is at risk because of the impact of the conflict. And with lower harvest in the coming season, that could only further deepen Sudan's hunger crisis.
Before the conflict erupted in mid-April 2023, Sudan was already a country in debt, huge debt. Commodity prices were going up faster and higher than ordinary citizens can keep a pace with. Now the country has been at war for half a year. Let's go beyond the numbers a little bit. Paint me a picture of the daily struggle of families to put food on the table amid this rampant insecurity.
Well, now, because of the conflict, so many people have been displaced from their homes, have lost their livelihoods, their jobs. We are seeing 5.8 million people who have fled because of this conflict. 1.2 million of them to other countries, and the remaining 4.6 within Sudan. So, for example, there are families that ran away from Khartoum, ran away from this violence, and now are staying in different places, like, for example, in Shendi or in Atbara or in Port Sudan, where they don't have a home and they don't have a livelihood. And so they're really dependent on support. And that's why it's critical for aid agencies like WFP to be there to provide support. But beyond that, as you had mentioned, the prices continue to get higher and higher. The price of wheat flour today is 55% higher than it was a year ago. And we are looking at incredible rates of inflation, around 200%. Just in a matter of weeks, the Sudanese pound has gone from around 580 Sudanese pounds per dollar to almost 900. And this macroeconomic crisis, which already existed before the conflict, is just being exacerbated and pushing the entire country into a deeper crisis.
We know Khartoum and Darfur have been the epicenters of this fighting between the army and the rapid support forces. What are some of the hotspots of this hunger crisis in Sudan?
The hotspots of the hunger crisis are very much in the Darfurs. Even before the conflict started, West Darfur was among the most food insecure states in Sudan. We are seeing the highest levels of hunger in Khartoum, in Kordofan, and like I mentioned, in the Darfurs. And it's where the fighting is happening that the people are the most food insecure, but that also makes it the most difficult to reach because of the insecurity, because of the clashes and limited humanitarian access. And that is a really great concern for WFP, as if the people, especially those who are the 6.3 million people who are one step away from a famine, do not receive assistance, it will push them even further into hunger.
That's Lenny Kinsley, WFP spokesperson for Sudan. She spoke with Nabil Biagio from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Now, for many immigrants, a mastery of everyday English does not mean they feel comfortable in all settings, like doctors' offices. That's why medical interpreters play a crucial role. But access to these highly skilled professionals isn't guaranteed for many Asian American and Pacific Islander community. Ali Rogin reports.
This one is good luck and happiness.
In San Francisco's Chinatown, Bi Huang sells jewelry and other Chinese goods as she has for the last 30 years. She calls her English halting, but she's fluent in salesmanship.
Queen Day, it's a Chinese symbol meaning is money.
I think the key to my success is my warm and welcoming service. I try to be inviting to my clients and I don't pressure them to buy anything.
In her shop, she strings English together as easily as beads on twine. But outside, it's different. Even routine doctor's appointments can feel foreign. So B usually requests an interpreter to speak her native Cantonese, a language spoken by over 85 million people worldwide.
It is essential to have someone who is able to translate for me while attending medical appointments. If there is information I don't understand, it can be pivotal to my health.
B is one of about 148,000, or 18%, of San Franciscans who speak a form of Chinese at home. Almost 90,000 of them have limited English language proficiency, or LEP. But B is one of the lucky ones. Many immigrant communities don't have access to the same types of language services. San Francisco's Chinatown is one of the oldest and largest in the United States, dating back to the 1850s. To this day, it's a central hub for Chinese American culture and life, but there are also many resources and services available to this community outside these gates. Northeast Medical Services, or NEMS, provides many of those services. At 14 clinics in the Bay Area, 90% of their patients are Asian. Most are low income and prefer to speak their native language. NEMS offers culturally relevant care like acupuncture and routine screenings for conditions that are particularly prevalent in Asian American communities like hepatitis B. Dr. Amy Tang is the director of immigrant health at NEMS. She says screening for and treating hepatitis and other common health care issues here reduces the risk of patients failing to follow up with specialists because of language barriers.
It's really important that we train our providers to manage it in the primary care setting and not have to refer out to specialists every time since it's so common.
Dr. Tang speaks Mandarin, and many staff members are at least bilingual. Most of the patients at this NEMS location are Chinese American.
We can also probe further about maybe reasons for reluctance or understand some of the cultural background norms of why they may be reluctant to try this medication or their fear about a side effect or their concern about a vaccine.
I'll choose Lao.
When doctors and nurses can't speak a patient's language, they'll use one of these devices, which connect to interpreters over video or the phone. But calls can get dropped, and wait times for interpreters can drag on past the appointment time.
For instance, I had a patient yesterday who spoke Indonesian, and she, of course, wanted an interpreter, rightly so. There wasn't one available. They said they would call back in 20 minutes with an update. And they finally did. Of course, our visit was already over.
But even patients who speak everyday English can miss out on medical nuances. Melody Schifino is a professor at UC San Diego's School of Public Health.
If your doctor can't understand you, you can't communicate with them, then you're more likely also not to be able to adhere to the treatment regimen. And so what could be something that we can easily manage manage with proper care ends up becoming catastrophic in many cases.
Hi, you ready?
Now let's see, 你準備好未啊? 我們可以進去了。
That's why the gold standard is in-person medical interpreters. Alice Wong is a staff interpreter at UC San Francisco Hospital and is certified in both Mandarin and Cantonese.
So I'm going to look in your ears first.
Today she's helping a Cantonese-speaking patient get fitted for a new hearing aid. Wong was born in Hong Kong. As a child, her family moved first to England and then to Hawaii. They spoke Cantonese at home.
I think a lot of immigrant kids go through this, where you have to, you know, ad hoc interpret for your mom or for your dad. I realized, wow, I think I could help people that way.
She says interpreters have to convey both the words and the intentions and desires of the patient and the doctor. That can, at times, be hard on the interpreters.
You tend to develop something that we call vicarious trauma. And that becomes quite, emotionally heavy. For me, it's worth it when I realize, oh, I was there to provide that communication, that information to them, so they can make better decisions.
Wong went through 40 hours of training to get certified as a medical interpreter, but that doesn't account for years of language and medical study.
As a doctor, you go into a specialty and you know that specialty inside out. For interpreters, we go to different specialties. We jump from one to the other, from neonatal, and then now we're going to cardiology. And so we have to learn all the basics of those terms.
It takes pretty much as much time as it takes a person to become a qualified nurse, a doctor, or any other healthcare.
Natalia Mitreva is the executive director of the Certification Commission for Healthcare Interpreters, which administers the program that certified Alice. Mitreva says recruiting interpreters is difficult, but it's even harder to retain them.
as they get involved more with healthcare, they see the attraction of becoming nurses, physicians, other healthcare providers, and they just move out after being, you know, in the field of interpreting for 3-5 years.
That helps explain why there are so few highly skilled interpreters in the United States. For example, there are 388 certified Mandarin medical interpreters and 177 Cantonese nationwide for more than 900,000 Chinese language speakers who do not speak English well or at all. Several laws mandate that all federally funded healthcare programs provide meaningful access to linguistically appropriate healthcare, but those are loosely defined terms with few enforcement mechanisms.
We really only get a count of self-reported hospital data that indicates, yes, we are offering some level of linguistic and translation services, but the quality of those linguistic and translation services is not necessarily clarified. The problem, I think, a lot of times is that the onus and the burden is on the patient, and that is inappropriate because this is already a vulnerable and marginalized population.
Only 16 states directly reimburse providers for language services provided to Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program enrollees. In 2009, California became the first state to require health insurance companies to cover interpretation services. Schaffino says more states should follow suit.
So I think considering something like that, I think would be very beneficial because third-party payers are able to really take advantage of these systemic benefits and economies of scale to really organize and deliver these opportunities.
But unless those changes are made, interpreters like Alice play a crucial role in this patchwork system.
You have to be really passionate to do this.
Yes. It's the passion for language. That's for me, it's a passion for language. The passion to, you know, also to remember where we came from and thinking about, you know, how we came, when we first came here, the struggles we had. How do I help the new people coming in?
I'm going to look in your ears first.
Because when language isn't a barrier, doctors can focus on their primary job, taking care of their patients.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Nicole Peters. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
We are here at Kalerwe Market, Uganda, Kampala, where in this whole market, women are crying out for their situations to change.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation each week right here on The Voice of America. Check your local TV listings.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.